All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksteens, what the fuckowitzes, what the fuckbergs, what the fuckmans? What's happening? What is happening? This is, I guess that's a special opening for the Jewish what the fuckers. Is everything all right? It isn't, right? It just isn't. I mean, Tina Turner is dead. It's just not all right. Another force of nature is now shuffling hard, sometimes slow and fast, off this mortal coil. What a fucking amazing performer. What an amazing person. What an amazing woman. I think I have more, like, there are some artists that I have in my collection that I have a lot of records, a lot of their records. And Ike and Tina are one of those artists. I have a lot of those records. And man, the really early ones, I know she became bigger, stronger, and more pronounced and amazing as a solo performer once she detached herself from the monster. But those very early recordings are quite insanely painful and amazing to listen to. And I listen to them often. And I didn't know her, and I haven't really known what she's been up to, but knowing she's gone is it's just another monumental fury of charisma and power removed. One of the good forces of nature taken away. Jesus, I'm stumbling through this like Kendall Roy at the eulogy. Holy fuck. I'm just, she wasn't young and she was ill, but it's just sad that this generation of people that had such a profound impact on so many, and especially my generation, I am late boomer, tail end. There's a whole generation of artists and amazing performers that are just slowly being picked off by mortality, being picked off by the unseen hand as it happens naturally. I'm just sad about it. I get today is, you know, I wake up and I try to deal and I don't know if I'm doing enough. Is there enough that any of us can do? My God, there is some shameless, just aggressive Christian fascism going on in this country, and out and outright fascism, just banning books, taking over school boards. I mean, it's just shameless what they're doing to the LGBTQ communities, shutting them out, shutting them down. Like all of those fucking trans jokes that so many of these hack comics fought so hard to have the right to say, which they do. Man, you really picked a good bunch of people to hurt, didn't you? I mean, Jesus Christ, can it get any harder? There's only one step left for how this culture is dealing with LGBTQ people, and that's killing them. Your neighbors might kill you. That's where it's at. Who are you going to be in that fight? Who are you going to be when they come for us? For whoever that is. Are you going to wear t-shirts that say, hell no, I'm not Jewish. Hell no, I'm not trans. Hell no, I'm not gay. Hell no. And on the back it just says, they're in the attic. Come on in. I mean, how easily do people adapt to some sort of status quo that is heinous? Heinous. How strong are you? How well do you know your neighbors? Do you still believe that most people in the quiet of their own minds and hearts and houses are going to do the right thing in the name of tolerance and respect for other people, humanity, progressive humanity? Or are they just going to buckle? Are they just going to buckle? I try to sort of believe that what we're doing here by embracing creative people, by embracing people's stories and how they do the work that they do, and I almost all of it is proactive work that affects other people. Today I talked to Amy Sherman Palladino, and she created the Gilmore Girls. She created the Marvelous Miss Maisel. She's been a writer. Her dad was a comic. And on a basic level, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is about Jewish entertainment. It's about what Jewish people at a different point in time, one of the choices they made to get through and connect and integrate into this country. And so many of those comics are so important to me growing up. But I mean, there is a flat out, shameless, culturally integrated anti-Semitism, anti-LGBTQ, anti-Mexican, anti-Black, anti-everything. And it's integrated. It's not marginalized. It's in the culture. You read about it every fucking day. It's happening. And look, man, you know, I believe that having these conversations that I have, and I believe that a lot of the art that's coming out and a lot of the stories that are being told and a lot of the movies that are being made are completely progressive, proactive, interesting, bold, courageous. But I was excited to talk to Amy Sherman Palladino because, you know, watching Mrs. Maisel, that era of comedy was very important to me growing up because my grandparents, my grandmother was a huge stand-up comedy fan, loved Don Rickles, liked Buddy Hackett. My grandfather loved the slapstick stuff, but they enjoyed the comedy. I used to talk to my grandmother a lot about it. Most of those comics when I was younger were the guys I saw on TV, that generation. Many of them are dead. Like, you know, you talk about Tina Turner's generation of performers. The generation before them of comedians really informed my sense of humor. Don Rickles, Buddy Hackett, Jackie Vernon, Rodney Dangerfield. You know, they were on TV, and I loved watching those guys. And Mrs. Maisel is of that era. But it was interesting to have the conversation because the guy she got to play, Lenny Bruce, in that show— is quite good, and I met the guy, and I was quite taken with the guy. But I think that he's a hard guy to play because what we know about Lenny Bruce and what I know about being around junkies in general or people that are hopped up all the time or high all the time is that, you know, it kind of takes over their body, and you feel the vibration, you feel the frequency. And, you know, once they get lost in it, it's hard to see anything else. So in that sense, outside of the Lenny Bruce records, which you can just hear the pace and you can hear the sort of like this guy wanted nothing more than to be liked and wanted to get laughs and wanted to charm people. Like he did all the voices. He had the shtick down. He had the rhythm down. And then he slowly over time, his brain, you know, broke apart and he became a vessel of something bigger than himself and changed not only the face of comedy, but the face of culture. But besides all that, the guy was a guy. And I was thrilled to talk to Amy about, you know, Kitty Bruce was involved. A lot of the monologues that they had of his were real. And also the character of Mrs. Maisel was right from the get-go when I first watched it, was sort of confounding to me, but I knew what was going on. I knew that this type of comic, especially a female comic at that time during that era, did not exist. You know, so this was created. To give her that voice and to give her that point of view and to give her that freedom of mind was a device, an invention. And I talked to her about that because I thought it was kind of genius. So it turns out that, you know, she's been rotating or around comedy. We just missed each other at the Comedy Store. It was a good conversation, and I'm glad I had it. And I'm glad that, you know, I feel lately sort of a reconnection or an openness or maybe a nostalgia for all the stuff that kind of defined me or that I gravitated towards when I was younger. A lot of old Jews. And also with music, too, that, you know, lately I've been listening to alongside of all this other stuff that I just mentioned to you. I've been kind of poking around in the towny rock that was, you know, part of my wiring when I was younger. And also those 8-tracks and stuff. I don't know if it's nostalgia or regrounding. I'm also revising my will. Look, hey, grownups, you know, get a will together. It's going to happen. Get a will together. Get a colonoscopy. Make sure you get your prostate checked. Do the tests that will enable you to know where you're at health-wise after a certain age. And just get some kind of will together. So if, God forbid, anything happens, you know, everybody you know or everybody in your family isn't scrambling to keep it out of probate and figure out who gets what and what happens now. It's a grown-up thing to do. It doesn't cost that much money. Colonoscopy, will. Okay? It's adult shit. You can do it. Seriously. So I talked to Amy Sherman Palladino about the show, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And that series finale is available tomorrow, May 26th on Prime Video. This is it. We talk about why that happened too. Okay, this is me talking to Amy. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer. And I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. What studio?
We're at Steiner.
Oh, Steiner. Oh, yeah. Those are big, big sound stages.
Yeah. It's a nice studio. Yeah. I will say.
We did the Joker there.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. When we did the pilot, we were in Tonytown, which is basically like any abandoned warehouse that they had a lock on. Yeah. But like there was barely a roof. And
oh, right.
It was just, they were just terrible.
Oh, really? So they hadn't really set it up as a studio yet?
There's a lot of places to film in New York that should not be places to film.
Sure.
But Steiner's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's great. And
it's a full facility.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many sound stages they got over there? They must have like six or...
They've just built like two or three other big
ones. Oh, really?
Ones. Yeah.
What are the tax incentives in New York? Are they good?
They're better now.
Oh,
they just knocked them up to like, I think it's 30%, but they also include the above the line, whatever. It's whatever. It was not as good before, and Kathy Hochul just pushed it through.
And now everyone's deciding they could use the money.
Well,
and they could deploy people.
Yeah. I just know for our show how much money we spread around town, which was a lot. It was a lot.
Just on food alone.
Yeah, seriously. Just for coffee alone.
Yeah,
but there's no filming in California anymore. Everything's like California has that weird lottery thing, and
I don't understand all that. All I know is that I'm optioning a book that was written by my friend, and I want to make it a movie, but it has to be done in New York. So I want good stories about being able to shoot a film in New York.
I think shooting in New York is the greatest place to film.
Right?
Yeah, it's amazing. The crews are so good.
Yeah.
They're fast and they're tough. They're very tough, but they're like, and they know how to like maneuver in tiny apartments or into an alleyway or you're stuffed in the back of a diner.
That's because that's all New York is.
Yeah. And they know how to do that shit. And New York has endless like buildings, and you go in these buildings and they've got rooms and there were clubs where rich people did rich things and now they just rent them out.
Doll them up?
Yeah.
Are they already set up or you have to?
Half the time they're just so beautiful. You just like, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
But like, so what were the sets? The apartment? The club?
Well, the first year was, we did the Gaslight and we did her apartment and things like that. The last year we built a strip club. We built a giant strip club, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And then this past season we built, we did like sort of our version of Johnny Carson. So we built
a whole studio
with a thing.
So what was shot in real life buildings and stuff?
A lot of stuff. Like just about anything that wasn't permanent that you saw.
What about the Schmata factory?
That's an amazing place out in Greenpoint. And that guy his story is incredible. He was in the Holocaust, he was in the camps, and he was a young boy, and they taught him to sew.
Yeah.
And because he was so good at it, they didn't kill him. And he would fix the officers' outfits, and he survived the Holocaust by learning to...
Yeah.
So he's got this... unbelievable. It looks straight out of the Garment District.
Huh.
And he's very tan with a dapper suit.
It's
like 3,000 years old. I don't know how old he is. Very little. But he boasts that every president but Trump
Yeah.
He made a suit for. And
oh, yeah.
It's just like, it's a really great, and we would use his workers.
Yeah.
Because they all knew how to
do the machines?
Work the shit. You know, we didn't know how to work any of that stuff. And they were great. They were like, you know, those tough broads.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
It was just amazing. It was so great to go back there.
Well, I was very taken with the show, and I was surprised, you know, at the beginning that I was, because I was ready to, you know, kind of like not.
Well, okay.
I was ready to judge it as sure. a comic. So, you know,
yeah,
I'm coming
no,
to
I
it.
No, I get that. I get that.
It was only because of that.
No, I totally get that.
And I was sort of like charmed by it. But I also realized, without knowing anything about it, that type of comedian in a woman or a man was rare. There were two.
Yeah.
So the idea that I don't think anybody picked up on initially was that you created this character who is a woman who could speak freely, which really wasn't the case because people were comparing her to Joan or to Phyllis Diller, but they didn't do that kind
no,
of stuff.
No.
It was all the only guy that was doing that was Lenny Bruce, and the guy that you got to play him was very good, you know,
Lou
and
Kirby,
that's hard. Yeah. I met him and I was very complimentary because, you know, I've seen Lenny and Lenny's like a, you know, he was like, you can't really hide the darkness in the real tapes of that guy.
No.
You know, he looked like he was, you know, it was a weird energy.
Yeah.
But that guy was, you know, he made it charming, I think was the real trick.
Well, he understood that he needed to entertain
yeah.
as well as have something to say.
Right.
And that I think was one of his, what really sort of set him apart is because he wanted the laugh. He, you know, he wanted to sing and dance.
Yeah,
and he would
yeah.
just do it.
Voices,
he just wanted
yeah.
you to, you know, when we decided to do this show, my dad was a comic. So
oh, I, know,
I
yeah.
grew up around comics and my fear was getting into this world was exactly that I did not want comics to look at this and go, you know, what the fuck? That's not at all the world. Now, it's a different time. It's a different
totally.
Era.
You were able to sort of like, you know, kind of reconstruct or re sort of what's the word I want to re understand an entire era
yeah.
or two, you know, through, you know, something that, you know, even like from the very beginning, I realized the scope of the staging was almost musical.
Yeah.
Like in terms of how, you know, the size of the sets, the patter, that like, you know, it wasn't like this is a historical document.
Right. We weren't making a documentary.
It's a reimagining.
Yes, a reimagining.
Of a period.
Yeah. Well, I grew up hearing stories from my dad of
well, let's go back. So where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the Van Nuys. I grew up right down the, take the freeway back the way I came.
So what was he, but the whole time, was he from New York?
My dad was born in the Bronx. And he started doing comedy in the Catskills.
So interesting.
And
he
got drafted and he went into the Army.
Which
and,
war?
Korean.
Yep.
And he went into the Army and he, you know, his story, which, you know, look, I love my parents, but any truth in my family is very rare. So I take everything with a grain of salt. But
wait, like total lies or just embellishments?
A lot of embellishments.
Yeah.
But his story was, he said to them, if you put me out there and you give me a gun, I will die. I will
right.
take a couple people with me.
Yeah.
And they said, well, what are you? What good are you to us? And he says, I'm a comic.
Yeah.
And they said, great, get up on stage.
Yeah.
And so he got up on stage and he did Alan King's act,
yeah.
I think, was the one. And he just did somebody else's act.
Sure.
From beginning to, because he didn't have an act.
Not uncommon then.
Yeah. And
actually.
So, and they said, great, okay. And so that was how he made it through the war. He claims he almost got run over by an ambulance. I don't know why he was on the ground or asleep. That was never told to me. But so when he got out of the army, then he started, you know, working as a comic and writing his own material. And my dad—
In
New York. And my dad had a— He had a run. He opened for Dinah Washington at the
what
Apollo. I was in 66 and then they moved to LA in 64. So I would say late 50s into the 60s. And
so a club act.
Clubs.
Dinner club
all
act.
All clubs.
Yeah.
You know, The Hungry Eye, Blue Angel, you know.
So who were his contemporaries that he hung around with?
Shecky Green.
Oh, yeah.
Jackie Gale. Dick Capri was my mother's maid of honor at their wedding, as
really?
She says. Yeah. We actually name-checked Dick Capri in the last episode, and I told my mom, I like, make sure he watches.
That's great.
And she keeps saying, when are you going to?
Yeah.
He doesn't want to keep tuning in to talk about him. you know, they talked about Bob Newhart and how they would all hide from him because he was so straight. He didn't do anything. Yeah. He didn't drink. He didn't do drugs or anything. So they would sort of like, shh.
Yeah, he was like, you know, he was Newhart, like he wasn't even a comic.
No.
I mean, like he came out of nowhere and it was the second show of the first time he performed that became that record.
Yeah. And that was it. And then off to the races.
Crazy.
There's
no other way for that guy to have come to be.
He was so great.
Yeah, but like he couldn't have, like I talked to him, the Cubs would have killed him.
Yeah.
If he had to come up in it.
Yeah.
Because he's such a sensitive.
He's sweet.
Yeah.
He's a sweetheart.
Yeah, you can't hang out with all those hard Jews.
Oh, it's so.
Get chewed up.
Clubs are a thing. They're a thing.
But at that time, you know, I didn't realize until I've read some, like, you know, like, what was that guy's name? John Berger's book. That, you know, there were literally, you know, people talk about there being so many stand-ups now. There were thousands.
Yeah.
After World War II, it was like anybody could do it. Everyone was stealing material. There were 20 guys out there in uniform doing stand-up. Right. It was crazy.
Yeah.
And there were all these dinner clubs, these mob-run dinner clubs everywhere.
Well, and they loved the mob.
Yeah.
I mean, my parents are talking about nothing about how, but you know, my mother was working at Mr. Kelly's in Chicago.
Right.
And
she lived in Chicago?
Well, she was working there. She was a dancer and she was working a club.
Oh, so doing a run?
She did like nightclub acts. And she either worked with somebody or she had her own little, her and a few guys.
Yeah.
She was cute. She was about this big, redhead.
There was I know that, you know, when I saw that she's a professional dancer, I always wonder about the goal of that pursuit.
Of dancing?
How many gigs are they? But like going into it, like, you know, comedy's crazy.
I know.
But like even acting's crazy, but I'm going to be a dancer. It's like there's three jobs.
Yeah, I know. I know. And the thing about dancing is you never make money. Unless you just never make money. There's no way to make money as a dancer unless you're Mikhail Baryshnikov and there's one. And
I just, it's such a princess dream.
It is.
But back then she could do backup.
It's a pure love of just that art form. And it's quick. It's a quick in and out, you know.
But, right.
You know, now with physical therapy and, you know, with all the stuff that you can last into your 40s, 50s, but, you know, not back when my mom did it.
Well, so what's she doing at Mr. Kelly's? What's the mom
story? She was doing a show there, and my father came into town to see her perform. Yeah. And the guys, and she loved these guys because they would make sure she ate, and then nobody hit on her, and she felt very protected. And my dad was sitting there, and they came over, and they introduced themselves, and they sat with him, and they said, listen, we're going to go outside and beat the shit out of this guy. You want to come with us? He goes, you know, I would, but my wife is about to, she's coming on any minute. I think she'll be mad. So, like, you know, maybe next time. Yeah. You know, so that is the Mr. Kelly story, possibly true in the Sherman household.
Sure,
Mr. Kelly story.
They would ask the Jewish comic if he would come out and help them kick someone's ass.
My dad was tall.
Yeah.
He was a big dude then. He was like 6'2" then, so he had some height on him.
Well, it seemed like there was sort of an unspoken or spoken kind of relationship because they owned all the clubs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you remember like when you were, how many kids in your family?
Just me.
So did you go to shows?
Well, as happens with comics, my father had a really good run and signed with the Maris Agency, and they brought him out here, and he started writing on the Bobby Darin show and anything with a name and a show. Mm. He wrote on for a while, and then my parents had I had a sister and she passed away very young and it threw everything into, as will happen, because you lose a child, that's it. Everything's different. So it kind of threw him off his trajectory. And for a long time, my mother was the breadwinner in the family. She started teaching dance and that's how we ate. And then my father started doing the cruises.
Sure.
And the great thing about my father and the cruises was he wasn't blue. He didn't work blue.
Well, that's still the way.
And
some of them have a blue night though. Like it used to always be you got to be clean on the boats, but now they have a blue show.
Oh, they do. They've got one dirty show.
Well, I don't know how exactly
it works. 11:45.
But there are guys that do the boats still. I mean, they do the boats.
I'm telling you, it's an amazing gig. My father has a very conversational way of, or he did.
Long form? So it wasn't one-liners? It was Alan King?
Stories.
Alan King.
Yeah.
Right.
So he would go on boats, and he would talk about the specific boat. So everybody felt like, oh, we're getting a special show that's just for us.
Right.
And the great thing about those boats is they're a scam. They sell you this thing. They say, don't bring your wallet. Yeah. Everything is free. It's included. You go, nothing's included. The minute you order a Diet Coke, it's $49.95. And then they bring you out to see an iceberg at 3 a.m, and you're standing there, and they bring these beautiful soup bowls around. Everyone's cold, and you eat the soup, and that's $58.95. So about halfway through a cruise, all the men realize they've been scammed, and they start to fight with their wives. And then the kids start to mobilize, and it's Lord of the Flies off, and it starts to get very frightening. And
this is just the way it was?
Literally, it's horrible. And so my dad would not work until halfway through the cruise, and he would come on, and he would just say, who else can't fit in your shower? Who else did I this thing? They were going to take me on a tour of the boat, and I got in a boat, and they put me on the boat, and I'm back on the boat.
Yeah.
So it's like he would talk about what a basically a scam the cruises are.
Yeah.
And it was so cathartic for especially these schlubby dudes who were dragged out there, and they felt so good and happy that by the end of the cruise, my dad was like Bono. all the old women just loved him.
They would write to him, and then
he started
saved marriages.
Oh my God. It was great to watch. So I actually didn't see my dad do stand up until I was about 13, 14 years old, because he was always on boats.
Uh-huh.
And I was, and so when I was 13, my dad said, come take a cruise with me to Mexico and we'll, a short one. Well, sure. I mean, that's good for the Sherman family.
Right.
And so I was, so my mom put me on a plane to Florida. I had to meet him in Florida because he was already out there. So I was going to meet him in the boat in Florida, and I got to Florida, and this is pre-9/11. So I got to Florida and he wasn't there. And I didn't have a cell phone.
Yeah.
And I just sort of said, I'm here for the cruise.
Yeah.
And people said, well, the bus over there is going to that boat. So I just got on the bus.
Right.
And I drove to the boat and I got on the boat and I said, I'm Don Sherman's daughter. And they said, okay. And they showed me to his cabin. And as I'm walking the cabin, I'm hearing people who will work on the boat saying, there's hurricanes and the entertainment's not going to make it in time. So I'm 13. I'm on the boat. I don't have money. I have nothing. I'm supposed to meet my dad.
Yeah.
I sat in the room for a while, and then there was the lifeboat drill, and someone said, you got to put your and come to your boat.
Yeah.
So I put my thing on.
Yeah.
I went out to the boat, and the boat's starting to pull away, and I'm like, well, at some point somebody's going to tell me to get off the boat or something.
Right.
But they literally at the last minute, the with him and a harp player, and with the spoons and whatever, and he was in a panic. But it was like I almost took a cruise by myself, which I was
very excited
about.
So where was your dad?
He was because my dad would get on a boat, but then he would either stay somewhere and work many boats, or he'd go from boat to boat to boat.
But that boat. But the one you got on, it was going to hit bad weather, so they basically canceled it?
No, my dad was stuck in bad weather. The boat that he was on was stuck out in a hurricane. And so he had to get from that boat to this boat.
That's crazy. So he's a real boat guy.
He was a boat guy. But it was amazing watching it, and it was amazing watching.
When did you get to see him finally?
Then, when he finally made it to the boat.
Oh,
we spent a week together, and I saw his act.
That was the first time, 13.
First time.
Did he do TV stuff?
He did some TV stuff, but he mostly, when I was really young, he was touring. He toured with Sergio Mendes, and he toured with Jose Feliciano. And
he was Paulie's dad, Sammy.
Yeah.
Like Sammy Shore.
No, Sammy was a friend. Mitzi was a very good friend of his.
Yeah.
So when I got old enough, Mitzi threw me a couple of jobs at the Comedy Store, and then promptly fired me when she realized I wasn't going to become a comic. Because those jobs were supposed to be for comics.
Which ones did you get?
When I was 18, I worked in the office.
Sure.
So I got to hand Sammy his $30 check, which was...
So, okay, that's going back when he was still around.
Yeah. And so I was there for a year. And then she realized I need that job for somebody else.
What was that in the 70s?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, must be.
And then when I turned 21, she put me at the
cover booth. Yeah.
And I worked in the OR.
Yeah.
And then I also worked in the main room.
In the cover booth?
Yeah.
Wow. So that was that was an informative time, but you were around then.
I was around then. The lineup right before I got fired the second time was Kinison and Arsenio Hall.
Oh, so that's
and
the 80s.
Dice and Charles Fleischer.
Yeah.
That was sort of like the main group that I would see.
Well, I must have just missed you. I was there 87. You must have been there in like 84, 83.
Maybe. I don't know. Sam was dating Tomoyo Otsuki and watching that, those two people fight.
I have a tape of that. That's in the OR.
It's the greatest thing in the world.
Because I lived in the house where Tamayo lived in Crest Hill. Oh. Like I lived there when I was a doorman. So Sam used to come up there and party for 3 days and yell.
Yeah. All they did was yell. All they did was get in fights at the back of the bar.
Yeah. Well, I have this weird tape that I need to digitize because I found it in Mitzi's office because they were cleaning it out. And I have, like, look, I have this. Look at these. Her driver's license.
Oh, my God. Why are these just sitting here?
Because, like, the binder did a dock, and the office was all, like, you know, a mess. So I asked if I could take some shit, and that was on the floor. So I'm like, well, Peter knows I have it.
That's amazing. Yeah, so great, though.
And then I got the one from 74. That's like, right after she took the place over.
Right.
So you were, your childhood, like, after you saw your dad do comedy, was it the idea that you were going to be in show business? Or?
Well, I mean, my family was not set up to do anything else. I when I had graduated and I was in my, like, I was like 23.
Yeah.
We were having dinner and my dad turned to me and he goes, did you want to go to college? Because we could have sent you. And the ship has sailed.
Yeah.
Because it was just, you know, my mom really wanted me to be a dancer, but she really didn't want me to move to New York. If you wanted to be a dancer, you had to move to New York. There were no California dancers.
But to do what? Be a Rockette? I mean, what's the big plan?
Broadway.
Okay.
Broadway.
Right. Musicals. Got it. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Musicals.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, I can't sing. I can't sing.
Okay.
So that's a problem.
Yeah.
It's an issue.
Yeah.
I was a good dancer, but it was not in the cards.
Yeah.
What happened is fine. My mother's not okay with it, but what happened was
still
fine. Yeah, I think she'd still prefer
after you, like, you made $1 billion in television, she's still like, you should have been a dancer.
Look, my mother is 92 and she's working on her fourth one-woman show right now and writing her memoirs, and I don't know what any of that means because this woman has worse punctuation than I do and cannot put a sentence together to save her life.
But she's going to ask you to help her out, isn't she?
No. She's got her own.
Who's going to publish a memoir?
I don't know.
All
I
right.
don't know. I'll bribe somebody to do it, but it's just, she's...
All right, so she's pushing you to be a dancer. You're in your teens?
Yeah, I was in dance class at 4, and I was dancing when I got my first job on Roseanne. I had a callback for Cats.
Yeah.
And for a touring bus and truck.
Right.
And which I never would have gotten anyhow because I lied and said I did gymnastics, which I didn't do.
Right.
And I got the call to, I had a writing partner for 1 year, and we got the call to that we got the job on Roseanne.
But you were doing scripts, you were writing things.
Yeah, I was in improv classes, and we were bored and out of work, so we would sit and we would write some spec scripts. And
for what?
I had a thing for Richard Lewis, so we wrote an Anything But Love spec script because I thought, well, you know,
did you know him?
Never met him. But
do you know him now?
Later, no. But later in life, he heard that story, and he actually left me a really lovely voicemail. I don't know how we got my.
Yeah.
But I never talked to him. But I have the tape.
Yeah.
I don't know what you play it in anymore because they don't have answering machines
right.
anymore.
Right. The little one? The little teeny tape?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You got to figure out
how
someone to. Well, no. I wonder what he thinks of the show. He's a big Lenny head.
Well, I hope, you know, we tried to be very, you know, Kitty was very involved because Kitty is.
Kitty Bruce.
Yeah. She controls all his material. So anytime we want, and we never wrote stand up for him. We wrote his dialogue, but we never wrote a word of stand up.
Yeah.
It was all his stuff.
Yeah.
So she had a lot of say and could have been a pain. And she was absolutely lovely. And she came down once and
did
the set. And she was
did
really.
Did she like how he played him?
She did. She did. She liked Luke a lot.
That's sweet.
The ladies like Luke.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's very likable.
He is. I'm telling you, I was totally surprised. Yeah, I was cynical. I was going in it with with the wrong glasses on. I was immediately engaged.
Well, he's such a worshiper of Lenny. It was weird because he came into audition for the pilot, and the Lenny Bruce character was in one scene. He was just playing like a strip club, and he was and there were like actually weirdly like three really good like one guy who looked just like him and did like a dead on impression, and then there was Luke, and then there was another guy who was also very good, and we sort of were going back and forth, and we said if we ever wanted to bring Lenny back and ever wanted to have him have a scene with a character, you got to go with Luke.
Yeah.
Oh, if you just want a dead-on impression.
Right, you're right. You know, it wasn't an impression. Yeah, he could act.
It was a sense of it, sure, but he's a really terrific actor. And Luke just knows everything. So I would...
He knew coming in or he knew...
He knew everything. No, he was obsessed with it. He knew all the recordings. And so every time I would... And there were so many different versions of the same bit because it existed in so many different ways that he did it that I would put something forth and he would say, but, you know, here he kind of did like, and he did some of that. Can I put that in?
Yeah,
and so it was a lot of like.
And Kitty's on set?
And Kitty was only on set once, but she, everything went to her and we had to say, you know, here's what we want to do. And we want to, and because we had to also mix and match pieces.
Right. Now, what about like Rachel? Like I've talked to her. We had a conversation in season one, like. It's very interesting to me, and it's not a criticism, but like, because I noticed this about, look, Steven Spielberg did a movie about his family of Jews with no Jews. And then, and then James Gray did Armageddon Time, a movie about his family with no Jews.
Yes.
And then Rachel, not a Jew.
Yes.
And how many Jews did you see?
Many, many Jews. Many Jews. Every Jew that left Egypt auditioned for Maisel. I will say that. There were many Jews. You know, the thing about it was a hard part.
It is. And a
lot of comics, good comics, came in and auditioned for it. But it was that mixture of, it was also the mixture of, especially at the very beginning, she couldn't be a polished comic. You had to watch, you had to know that the spark was there, but you had to watch the evolution because that's what the show was.
What's interesting about her and why it worked from the very beginning is because she has that as a character, I don't think as a person, but she has that kind of like almost sociopathic self-centeredness.
Oh my God, a complete narcissist.
Right, that you need to just plow ahead.
Yeah.
Like, you know, right from the beginning, it's so clear that there's that disconnect between emotional capacity and her desire to do this thing.
Well, because the thing about comedy is you have to be willing to talk about your life.
And if you want to do that kind of comedy, sure.
Yes, yes. Yeah. You know, and you have to be willing to potentially upset people in your life because you are being honest and you are talking about the things that happen.
Right,
and
but that's a modern configuration. You chose to construct a character and time travel her.
I did, but you know, part of the way I did her comedy was because I knew I was dealing with an actress and I was not dealing with a comic.
It's probably better because like comics, it's hit or miss with the acting.
Well, it's tough.
Yeah.
It's a hard combination to get, you know, the actors can't play musicians.
Well, right, because the comedians have that thing we just talked about. So you're going to tell them instruction, but they're going to have that weird disconnect where, you know, they don't have the right amount of capacity for engaging, for eliciting.
We always had comics in our room on staff. They would jump in and they would say, that's bullshit. Or they would jump in and say, it doesn't, here's the experiences.
With the bits.
And with everything.
Right.
With clubs, with how much time you get, with every little tiny thing, because I wanted to make sure that it felt, especially in the beginning, was as she was learning and as she was putting it together, I wanted to make sure that they would look at it because I didn't want her to like come out and boom, she was the funniest thing in the world and knew how to craft a joke and knew what the whole thing was.
Right.
And so it was they were sort of like keeping us in check. But the other thing about Rachel was for her to be able to play this part, she had to have an emotional thread in whatever monologue she was doing, even if it was a quickie. There had to be something in it, and we tried to always tie what she was talking about to something that was going on within the show.
Sure.
So she had something to grasp onto. Yeah. And then you could structure jokes around that, and you could work with her. And she was the great thing about Rachel is because she's so smart, and she's so fearless, and so doesn't really care what people think about her, and I mean that in the best way, because she would be up on stage with a room full of extras staring at her.
Yeah.
She's the star, and she would say, tell me how to say this.
Yeah.
Tell me where the inflection, because she just wanted it to be right.
Right.
Then she would get up and work it. And there were times where she would come to me and she would say, I need something to get me to this.
Yeah.
I need something to get me to this. So the monologues were very much about letting her feel like there was an emotional story connection, because then she didn't feel weird going out doing jokes. I think if we had just given, because, you know, like Joan Rivers, she had these great jokes.
Sure.
But I think if I had just given Rachel great crafted jokes, I don't know that she would have known how to do them, because she was thinking.
Yeah, and that's and it's like the possibility for failure would have been high.
Yeah.
Because there is a way to shtick.
Yeah.
And that's not what she's doing.
Yeah.
So that choice was to create this character. It almost becomes all the way through. Once she has success with the tour, with the R&B group, or that guy.
Yeah, Shai Baldwin.
Yeah. And then, you know, just onward. It's seeing this, the reimagining is really kind of an alternative feminist history of this period of show business.
Yeah, right? It is. I mean, we you know, people keep saying, well, who did you craft her after? And my honest story is my dad.
Sure.
Because I grew up with these stories. I mean, I stripped stuff out of his life. He toured with Johnny Mathis. You know, I did things that he came, you know, he told me about. And I said, well, I don't know a good thing.
And also, like, it's interesting that, you know, he started stealing from Alan King, because that, you know, is really, you know, out of... Alan King was the guy that, you know, made the middle class Jew, you know, a thing.
Yeah.
You know, he pulled it out of the borscht belt and made it, you know, it was back. It was, you know, it was the passing bit.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
But it was about life. It was about middle class life. And, you know, and Midge, Rachel's Midge comes from, it's almost pre-middle class, but it's upper class. They live well.
Yes. That was back in the days when if you were a tenured professor, you had a beautiful apartment on the West Side. They gave it to you.
But that's the style, right? So that's it. So it's not really a Lenny Bruce thing. It's really kind of that, you know, it's those Jews who were talking about bourgeois life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then by making her a female
as
opposed to my father,
it allowed
sort of a... Well, I never looked at it as a feminist show, because I don't ever look at my work.
I just
work
say that
like
because
that.
Like it's a point of view thing.
But it does,
you know, it's important.
But it came off a little like that, and I'm fine with that. Like I'm not upset with that. It's just it allowed sort of a point of view that made it less, because the thing I was really concerned about is I didn't want people to look at this and think like that's my grandma's show. I wanted people to be able to enjoy it, and I wanted young women to be able to watch it and not feel like, eh.
What do you know about the audience?
I want to see girls.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that by watching her struggle and watching her come from this, and this adorable girl, because Rachel's so damn cute with the cute clothes and everything, and yet can't hold the husband, has, you know, going up against the family, going up against not getting the respect, like it made all of that palatable, and it made her more human.
So what do you know about the audience in general?
Nothing. I don't know anything about
because
it.
It's interesting because
they're alive and they're out there.
Well, I imagine that, you know, there is that generation of people that, you know, enjoy the Alan Arkin, you know, Michael, what is that show called? The Kaminsky Method.
Yes, yes.
Like clearly there's an audience of people of our parents' generation that are engaged in stuff that speaks to them. So I think that you have this spectrum of people that can be pulled into this because it has the trappings of their past.
Yes.
And it speaks to the experience of that, and the patter of it kind of is reminiscent of something they grew up in, but yet it's really a young people show.
It is a young people show, although the interesting thing is the gripes about the show that I heard mostly through the filter of Rachel Brosnahan, who cannot put her phone down. I love her so much, but it's like, baby, put the phone down. Just put it down.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this issue about you're a bad mother. You're a bad mother. And this became a very big issue. And Rachel talked to me about it a lot. And at first I was very cavalier about it. And I said, you know, Rachel, I don't give a shit. I don't care what you read online. I'm not on social media.
Right.
We're not doing the show for the six people who are calling you a bad mother.
Right.
But then like I would have New York Times say, so what's this thing about the mothering?
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, so this is a thing, really? Yep. In this day and age where we're talking about women and this and that, you're asking me like she's a bad mother because she's got ambition and because she wants to go on the road and she wants to have a career.
Yeah, but what the fuck is that? I mean, it's like, you
so
know, you
weird.
Listen, but you listen to the stories of any entertainer's family. They were all shitty parents.
Of course, that's the point.
And it's like, you know, they make a choice to do this thing.
You need shitty parents to make more entertainers.
Right, like Buster Keaton was used as, like, you know, just fodder.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like there's no – it's an interesting thing that you're putting this modern sort of point of view into the past, and then these people are criticizing her on behalf of what?
It was huge.
A domestic expectation?
It was huge. And they would ask everyone about it. They would ask Alex Borstein about it, who didn't have kids in the show.
Well, she's another interesting character because at the beginning, she was the one I had the most trouble with because I thought it was broad. But then you just start to realize she's just weird.
Yeah.
And then it kind of settles, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And Alex is – Alex is a very special
talent. Yeah, I just talked to her. Yeah.
She's because she brings a level of pathos into the room with her. Mm. And it's what grounded Susie. Because Susie was such a ball busting, fuck you, I don't care. Whatever I think I say, you know, I'm going to be alone anyhow, so I'm not even going to try to connect with humanity.
Right.
But there was there's such vulnerability in Alex Borstein as an actress and as a person that it actually took this character that could have gone much more in the stratosphere, and it sort of tethered her to the
earth. I can see that. So like, but this is like, this show is not, it's not like anything that existed before, really. Like, you know, in the way that, you know, it's not like a three camera trip. It's not, you know, it's not quite a movie, but it engages all these devices of, you know, old movies in a way. But like, how do you, like, when you started writing, we were talking before that you were doing spec scripts for Richard Lewis and you're like just, you're just general show business family. You're dancing.
Yeah.
You're working at the Comedy Store. Yeah. Was Roseanne at the store when you were there?
Roseanne?
She had just left probably.
She would come in every now and then. Like, she came in and bombed one night and then just screamed at the whole audience and then left. So like,
but she's still doing that.
Yeah. So there you go.
But so what, how does it unfold? So you spent like a long time at the store at that time. So you saw everybody.
I saw everybody. And it was really, it was, you know, and I also saw, and I wish I could remember his name because I use this example all the time.
Yeah.
He was a guy, he was so sweet. He was this very tiny guy, but it's so lovely. And he would come in and he always had an early slot.
Yeah.
And he would, I think he emceed a little bit, but he would emcee and then his actual slot was later and he would come in early and he was sweet and adorable and he would stand at the back and he would drink and he would drink and he would drink and get nervous and drink and drink. And by the time he went on stage, he was so angry. He assumed the audience was going to turn on him before he walked up on stage and he attacked immediately and he bombed almost every time he went on stage. And then I would see him the next night at the beginning of the night and he was sweet and adorable. It was, I'm like...
Yeah.
Just don't drink.
Yeah,
See what happens if you just go. But
Mitzi, I think kept him in that late spot.
The fear.
Yeah.
The fear of, like, comedy is so fear-driven. It's so interesting because I saw, you know, I think comics, personally, I think it's the art form. I think it's the most terrifying art form out there because if you go up there and you bomb, you can't say, oh, the script was bad or the director hung me out to dry or my dress looked like shit or my actor.
Yeah.
It's you. They don't like you. They don't like what you're saying. They don't like your point of view. Your life is not interesting to them.
Right.
It's total and utter rejection of everything that you are. That's so hard.
Well, it's crazy, but like I used to say that, like, really, for as long as it takes, you know, about 75% of the job is pretending you're not afraid.
Yes.
And then eventually you're not. Because it doesn't matter as much anymore. And you,
you're just numb to the world.
Well, no, you're not numb, but you know, it's like any other job that, like, some nights are better than others.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get past a certain point where you're going to be run off stage, probably.
Yeah.
Unless something really fucked up happens.
Yeah.
But so when you watched it, the nuts and bolts of it every night when you're working the cover booth at the store, I mean, were you empathetic?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was very empathetic. It broke my heart a lot. And, you know, I had to turn the light on in the OR when you sat at the cover booth.
Eddie Cantor's.
You had to give the light.
The Eddie Cantor picture?
Yeah. And it was horrible. It was horrible, like, having to, like, say, like, and you're done. You know, it was just.
But that was right. But they had a certain amount of time.
I know they had a certain amount of time. But it was weird for me because I was not. I didn't have that ambition.
But did you think you did? Is that why you got the job?
No, I think it's just because it's all I knew. Like, I grew up with that. I needed a job.
Yeah.
And my dad got me the job. Mitzi always was very sweet to my dad. And, you know, according to my mother, she was in love with your dad. Mitzi was in love with your dad. I don't know if that's true, but according to my mother, Mitzi was in love with my dad.
The great love of her life, I think, was Steve Landisberg.
Oh, really?
Yeah. After Sammy, it was Steve Landisberg. And then she, I think, went through a dark period where she just fucked a lot of comics.
Yeah, she. I think her boyfriend was Danny.
Danny Stone. Yeah. I must have just missed you.
I mean, come on.
Were we there together? Well, for fuck's sake.
I think we were. What happened? Why did you notice me?
That's crazy. Because Danny Stone, all he did was that fucking. It was the weirdest thing that they were together. Like all he did was Dangerfield. The Dangerfield impression.
Argus Hamilton.
He's still there.
At the Comedy Store.
Yes, every night. He's grandfathered in. He's as long as he's alive, he gets an opening spot. He comes in, parks his Cadillac, does like the second spot in the main room, and leaves.
Unbelievable.
And he kills, man.
Really?
And you know who else is there again? Dreesen.
Really?
Yes. And it's the same thing like with Miss Maisel in a way. Is that like I watch Tom Dreesen. And same with Argus. This is old style patter.
Yeah.
The way they do jokes. And I think for people of a certain age, it's very comforting.
Yeah, it is comforting.
It's like, it's the-
And it's funny.
Sure, it's funny.
You know, it's fucking funny.
Yeah.
It's just-
But it's a style that you don't, there's very few people that do it anymore. Like, yeah, you know. The guys who carry that tradition are rare. You know, like Dave Attell is like the best example of a guy who like lives in that and took it to another dimension.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So Comedy Store Talk. So you got out.
And I got out.
As a writer, that's where when you got your job?
I got my job a couple of years later.
How'd you get the job on Roseanne? That was the first job?
It was literally like, yeah, it was just, it was a fluke. And it was, I hate telling people this, like young people who are like, how did you get in? I'm like, you don't want to hear my story because it sounds too easy. I had a partner for like 1 year. We were in the Groundlings.
Who's that? She around?
School together. Her name was Jennifer Heath. And she was actually, I thought she would have been a really, she did stand up. But Jennifer, and she was very funny, but Jennifer didn't like clubs. She didn't drink. She didn't like people who smoked. She couldn't take the clubs, so she couldn't do it. I mean, you got to be at the club to do stand up.
Yeah.
So it didn't work out. But I actually thought if she had a belt and a smoke, she would have been really great. But we were in the Groundlings loser classes together, and then we decided we'll write a couple. She really wanted to write a spec script.
Yeah.
I'm like, fine, I don't care.
Okay.
So we wrote two spec scripts. We wrote a Anything But Love, and we wrote a Roseanne spec script. And I was in, and I realized, oh, God, if I'm going to do this, I got to learn how to use a thing because I don't even know how to type. So I went to take a class at UCLA, which was, I don't know why they exist, but the teacher of that class was a very nice man who I also can't remember his name.
Yeah.
That's welcome to my world.
A TV writing class?
It was a TV writing class, and he was working on a show called City that had just been picked up with Valerie Harper, and he wrote Crash.
He was running the show?
He was a comedy writer. Paul Haggis.
Yeah.
So he said, well, come in and you guys just pitch a bunch of stories.
Yeah.
And I said, all right. So we went in there and we pitched a bunch of stories, all which were absolutely just dreadful.
Yeah.
But we didn't know what the show was or anything like that. And Paul Haggis said, okay, well, look, take your pencil and if you can throw the pencil and sticks in the ceiling, we'll hire you.
Yeah.
Which sounded, I didn't know anything about sitcom hazing at that point. I'm like, that sounds insane. And so 45 minutes later, everybody wanted to go to lunch. And he's like, that's fine. So we actually got a freelance script on City and off that. And so by the time we got meetings with agencies, we had already been hired with something. So
you had a thing. You did an episode of City.
Right. And so from the time we wrote those spec scripts, the time we got on Roseanne was 6 months. And it was a very quick.
First season of Roseanne?
No, it was third season.
So all right, she was up and running and she was already huge.
She was with Tom. Yeah, she had just broken up with her husband the season before and fired everybody. Everybody that was there, all the writers, they were starting fresh. And Bob Meyer came in, he was running the show, and they had no women. So they needed a cheap team of
Who was in the
girls.
Room?
Bob Meyer, Chuck Lorre, Jeff Abagoff, Brad Isaac, Joel, Don Foster.
Wow.
And then me and Jennifer.
So, and it was already like a machine.
It was huge. And like we walked into like a huge show.
Right, but everyone, the characters were defined.
It was an unbelievable first job.
Yeah.
It was so lucky. She had just done the national anthem when we got hired.
Right.
So the first time I met her, we went over to the house that they were renting that later they were sued for trashing that house. It was in Brentwood somewhere.
Her and Tom.
Yeah. So we went over there and the whole time they just had taped every news show that was talking about her, and they were just watching. We just sat there and watched everybody trash her and trash her and trash her. And then she and Tom started finding it funny, and they started fooling around, and then they started making out, and then he unzipped her pants, and then we all got up and we left the house. And so that was my first introduction to Roseanne as a person. But I
like everybody abruptly got up.
We just we were.
I love those moments with crazy people.
It's time to leave.
It used to happen with Sam up at Crestal, where just sort of like, what's going on? Everyone just goes.
Yeah, let's just go. Let's just go. We don't need. We get it. We know what's going to happen.
No goodbyes.
We're fine.
Yeah.
thank you for the burger. But I will say, you know, going on to a show like that that had as crazy as she was.
Yeah.
What she brought to the table, nobody could bring to the table.
Well, she's fucking funny.
And of such a clear point of view, such a clear who I am, what my story is. And then they surrounded her with John Goodman, Laurie Metcalf. I mean, it was just like, it was gold.
But also, like, you know, she, I think one of the great things about that thing is that she grew as a character.
Completely.
And like, that just, it's not always the thing that happens.
But they
as the kids grew, everybody grew.
I will say they wouldn't do now what they did then. And they knew, for example, they knew John was the right husband for her.
Right.
John was busy. He was doing Julius Caesar on, he was the Old Globe, I think. And, and they had to wait. That's why it was a mid-season show.
Yeah.
Because they could have cast somebody else, but it wouldn't. They needed to find somebody that would let her have the space to become an actress and yet not tamp down who she is. And they found between Lori and John.
Yeah.
And you would see
great
them.
Actors.
I mean, the best.
Yeah.
The best. They could make anything funny.
Yeah.
Anything funny. And it was just, it was like a marvel to watch. It was also because the mantra of the show was make the small big, make the big small.
Yeah.
We weren't writing like they're all stuck in an elevator.
You know, right.
We were writing like stories of family stories.
Right.
Like
yeah.
shit that really happened.
Yeah.
And there was no, you need a certain amount of laughs per page. There
right.
was, just like let it happen.
Yeah.
Let the scene happen. And if there's no laughs, there's no laughs.
Right.
Is it interesting? Great.
Well, that's a kind of a, that must have been a fairly new thing.
It was.
But, well, I mean, I guess though, like, you know, with those 70s shows, like Mary Tyler Moore, Lou Grant, I mean, there were definitely serious episodes of
there
comedies.
There were serious episodes, but I don't think anything had this level of just be. First of all, I mean, just the look of.
Right. Well,
look
family
at
stuff.
Was wrong.
It
was completely different. You know, that they are a couple in love. They still like to have sex.
Yeah.
It's like that, just the visual. It's not Mary Tyler Moore. It's not, you know.
Right.
And then also, she had banned the studio and the network from the stage for whatever reason.
Right.
So when I came in as a newbie, there were no notes.
Carsey
there
Warner
was no way to
they were sent
read.
Away.
They were gone.
Yeah.
I never saw them. And we would have our table read, and then we would go do our work, and she would. And it was just like a weird, fucked up summer stock company because you were just doing the stuff.
But that's nice. It is almost like theater. Everyone's involved.
It was
collaborative.
It was the best until I went to a different show and I realized who are all these people sitting around and why are we listening to them? It's like, well, that's the studio and the network, and they have opinions, and I'm like, oh my god, because I think if I had started with that, I don't know that I even would have been a writer. I didn't want to be a writer.
So how long, how many seasons were you there?
I was there 4 seasons.
That's a lot.
Yeah, I was there. I have the record. I think I have the record. Eric Gillen may have beat me by a bit, but I think I have the record.
And why'd you leave?
It was time.
Oh,
it was
time.
I was, you know, she once said, I will never have a woman run the show because it's no fun being mean to a woman. And everyone who ran the show at a certain point, she turned on them and made their lives a living hell.
Right.
Not the whole time.
Yeah.
It was like there was a certain point toward the end of the season. She's like, and now.
Yeah.
And,
oh, really?
And then she would usually fire them. So it was sort of a, and I had different interactions with them. I wrote a pilot for them because they told me I had to.
With Roseanne's production company?
With Roseanne and Tom. And they, it was for En Vogue.
Wow.
It was insane. And then they broke up.
So you stayed through all these different staffs. I mean, comics wrote at some point.
Yeah.
Wasn't Alan Stevens in there? And,
yes. Alan Stevens was not my year. The year after me, I think the year after I left, the staff started to get really big and she started to pull a lot of comics in. When I was there.
Was that the last season? Or the last couple, or
Well, no, I mean, I was 3, 4, 5, 6.
But how long did it go on for?
And then they went to 7, 8, 9.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah, it went on. And then it went on to, like, we've won the lottery and the train and Steven Seagal and blah, blah, blah. But I will say, like, I think it was, if I had been on any other show as my first job, I just don't know that I would have. Because writing inherently is not a fun job.
I hate it.
It's the worst.
I hate it.
It's depressing. It makes you feel bad.
I hate being in a room. I hate being in front of a blank page.
I agree. It's terrible. And I didn't like writer's rooms because at the time, writer's rooms were very male. And it wasn't even that I felt like, oh, it's so misogynistic. It was just like a dirty, you know, like everyone sort of smelled weird and, you know, everyone picked up the trades to go in the bathroom. And it's like, my God.
It'd be just sit there for hours. Yeah, sometimes nothing happens.
Just the worst. And I was
eating.
It was terrible. It's a terrible environment.
So
I hated it.
So after you leave, though, what do you just do? You do other, just you're just around just doing episodes here and there?
Well, I wrote a couple of pilots. And not realizing that, you know, I always had sort of like a, I always felt like I was going to leave. Uh-huh. Like I wasn't going to be a writer forever. Right. So I always felt like, well, I'm not really.
What do you think you were going to do? Dance?
I don't know what thought. I didn't. There was no, my family was not big on planning. We sort of fell into stuff.
Yeah, I know that. I know that feeling.
And
yeah.
So I kind of dicked around for a while. And then I was on a couple of terrible shows that were just like, just painful to be a part of, mostly because the more I learned about the backstage part of it, the creepier it all got. It was just like,
in what way?
Well, you know, I was there when Les Moonves would come down and you know, they'd go off and talk about, we're gonna go get the Heidi girls.
Yeah.
And it's like, I really don't need, I just don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
Do whatever you want to do. Yeah. I just don't want to see it, you know? And the ugliness of, you know, I did a show and the creator was a female.
Yeah.
She was sort of a playwright and then she did some movies and stuff like that. And she and another guy on the started to have some sort of relationship. And there was a lot of them going to Benihana's and I'm stuck with the room. And then the studio coming to me and saying, so tell us what's going on with them. And I'm like, you know, I'm just writing terrible jokes in the other room. That's all you need me for. You don't need me to spying. Yeah. And they would say, well, we need you to rewrite stuff behind their backs. And I'm like, I'm not going to do that. Like, I just don't, please.
Right.
Just find someone else to do that shit. It's just not who I am. So, but that's what the business was. It was kind of gross and ugly and I was not a staff person. I needed to either.
Well, so did you like lose it?
No, I just kept humping it. And then I got on a show that I truly learned what my limits were. And I was running a room and I lobbied for the job. It was called Veronica's Closet.
Right.
And I lobbied for the job because I said, I've got to get that executive producer credit. I got to get my own show on the air.
Right.
I've got to do it myself.
So you knew that.
I knew that. Yeah. I knew that much. I said, if this is going to take, I got to be the one. I've got to hold the pencil.
Yeah.
I can't be the person who feels like I can fix it and not be allowed to fix it.
There's some real crazy on that show.
Yes.
Okay.
And there was. And from many different.
Ron Silver and Christy Alley.
Oh, Ron Silver, who had his manager call me and said he doesn't. There was a joke about something in Yiddish. And his manager called me and said he does not want you to call him a Jew on the show. And I said, he played Alan Dershowitz.
Yeah.
He got a fucking Oscar nomination as Alan Dershowitz. He's Ron Silver. Look at him. He's a Jew. What do we want me to call him? We want you to call him Armenian. And I'm like, okay. All right. That's great.
So you get your executive producer credit, but like, what'd you learn?
It was horrible. But I didn't get to pick my staff. My staff was picked by the powers that be. And I had a room full of people who all wanted to be on Friends. And who did not have any interest in writing on a show for two women in their 40s who were not hot.
Yeah.
And it was a constant litany of every pitch was a fat joke. Every you know, and it was just, it was constant. And it was just like, I had no control over the room because these people weren't loyal to me. They would all like stare next door because the friend's room was next door.
Oh, wow.
The cool room. And yeah, the yeah. good kids were next door. Right, and like, yeah. we're in the shit room. And it was just like, it was like, this wasn't even my show. And I'm like, come on.
Yeah.
Cheerleading and like yeah. Yeah. And I later just recently found out that one of my writers was a serial rapist for 20 years. He's in jail.
I know that guy, Eric
Weinberg. Yes, yeah. Yes. And the weird thing about Eric is you could look at him and know he was a serial rapist.
Yeah, I didn't know him that well, but I think he wrote on Bill Maher's show.
Yes, he did.
Right.
He bye bye.
Yeah.
No one misses you.
Yeah.
But it was that kind of, I mean, it was a toxic, you know. He was there, and the young men worshipped him, and they followed him, and it was just like,
Eric?
It was like an endless beating your head against a wall, trying to make that show something good.
And he was working against you.
Well, the whole system was,
right.
frankly, the whole system was working against me.
Yeah, because he was such a dick.
He was a dick. But, you know, Kirstie is Kirstie, and Kirstie had her own belief system, and
yeah.
they didn't appreciate that.
Yeah.
belief system, but they certainly knew who she was when they got into bed with her.
What they just saw, like, well, we've got this production company, which is, you know, we got these names, people seem to be interested.
And she was the biggest star. I mean, she's coming off of Cheers.
Yeah.
She was the biggest star. She, when Veronica's Closet went on the air, she was the highest paid person on television.
Right.
You know, and God knows she's talented.
Yeah.
She's so funny. Yeah. Kathy and Jim, they were funny people.
Yeah, yeah.
Daryl Chill Mitchell was on that show. Yeah. He was great. I mean, there were great people on the show. The show could have been, if anybody had given a shit, it could have been something really terrific. The talent was right there.
Yeah.
And it drove me nuts that I'm the only one fighting for something that is even mine.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where it felt like, unless I was going to be willing to break down and cry every single week.
Yeah.
This was not a, I would come home at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Every night.
Yeah.
I'd get into bed and I'd cry.
Yeah.
And my husband would say, you've got to quit.
Yeah.
You've just got to quit. I can't.
How long did that go on for?
The whole year, the whole season.
That's terrible.
But I'm not a quitter. I didn't want to quit. And they didn't want to fire me.
Yeah, but that was the expectation. Like, you know, that people would stay all night and then take abuse from executives.
It was the worst. It was absolutely horrible. It was the worst experience of my life. And I will say, like, I thought David Crane was a delightful man, and I think he's very talented, and I appreciated any time that he was in the room, but they weren't in this room.
Yeah.
And I had people actively working against me outside of the room. I mean, they literally hired my replacement mid-season. I was in the trades, and I'm showing up to work, and I'm saying, like, you know, guys, could you hide it from me, like, little bit? Because I'm still humping this show till 5 o'clock in the morning every fucking night. Could you maybe just pretend? Could you hold the announcement just like a month? Maybe
right.
it was just so awful.
It's abusive.
It was abusive.
Yeah.
It was abusive. And it was the kind of thing where the first day I got the job, a couple of writers of other shows of theirs, not Veronica's Closet, but they had two other shows going. They took me out for drinks and they just told me, like, it's an evil place and it's horrible.
Yeah.
And I wanted to not believe that. I wanted to say, look, let me have my own experience.
What, all of the shows or just that one?
The system.
The umbrella.
The system.
Yes. Okay.
The system was not a warm, fuzzy system.
Right. Sure.
It was a system that you were going to have to, like, you know, get some therapy.
So this for. Like, you know, upon your realization of, you know, what was going on behind the scenes, this was like the hitting of bottom.
It was. And I just thought, you know what, this is not for me. I don't want to be in this world. I don't like this world. I don't want to be in this room. I just started, like, sending them home, and I would just finish the script by myself. And there were a couple of girls that I that were great.
Yeah.
And they would sometimes stick around and help. But it was easier for, like, get most of the joke pitching done, send everybody home. And I would just sit there till 6 and I would just get it done because it was too ugly. It was too ugly. And then knowing that Friday was going to come, they were going to appear. They were going to see the run through. They were going to throw the script out because they threw it out every time we had a run through, everything like that.
Yeah.
And then we were going to work all night again. And Friday night was the night that I was always called into the room to be told what I have done wrong in the week.
Yeah.
And this one particular Friday, I just said, look, if this is going to be one of those meetings, can we do it Monday morning?
Yeah.
Because I've just got such a rewrite to do.
Yeah.
And they said, okay, we'll see you Monday. And so Monday morning I came in and it happened on Monday. But, like, over that weekend, that was the weekend I decided, look, I'm not going to cry anymore. I'm not going to do this anymore.
Yeah.
I'm not going to have somebody wait for me to cry, pick up a tissue box and hand it to me and go, we all cry here.
Yeah.
It's like, why? We're doing fucking comedy. Why are we all crying here? It's a terrible thing to do.
Yeah.
So I quit sitcom. I said to my husband, I can't do it anymore. And he says, great, don't do it.
Yeah.
He was working on Family Guy. He goes, sit at home, figure out what you want to do.
And what did you?
I sat at home and I wrote Gilmore Girls.
That's what you did?
Hmm? I sat at home. Courtney Love was dating Edward Norton.
Yeah.
She was renting a place across the street from me. So I would just sit. I would sit at my couch, and at 3 o'clock, he would come up, and she would run out of the house.
Was that where, like Whitley Hills or somewhere?
Like the Larchmont
area.
And then I would just sit there and watch them for, they seemed very happy together for a moment.
Yeah.
And then I wrote Gilmore Girls, and that was.
And he sold it with your husband? Or was that just you?
That was just me. Yeah. I you know, I went in for a meeting at the WB, and I said, I have this, and Susan, who had been trying to get me in there for a while, and I said, well, here's my pitches.
Yeah.
And I said, there's a mother and daughter, and they're more like friends. She goes, I want that.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be an hour. And I said, I'm a half hour. What do you, an hour? What is that? Just more pages?
Yeah.
I'm like, what? It's single spacing. It's like, oh, that's, hour sounds really hard.
That's a lot of pages.
But fuck it. You know, it's, what did I know? I didn't know anything. So I sat at home and I wrote Gilmore Girls and I've had my own show.
And for a long time, a very popular show.
Yeah, it was good.
And it holds up?
I guess so. Because when it went on Netflix, that's actually when it really gained most of its audience. It always had like a fan base.
How many seasons was it? Six?
Six, seven seasons. Seven seasons. I wasn't there the last season, but it was seven seasons.
But like, because I know I dated a woman who was obsessed with it, but I mean, she would watch it all day long.
It happens a lot. And it's a very big cancer show. So I cannot tell you how many letters I got that said, I watched this with my mother while she was going through chemo. I mean, like stacks and stacks.
Makes them feel better?
I didn't, I guess. And I would say to Lauren and Graham, and she would say, our motto should have been Gilmore Girls were bigger than cancer, because she got the same things. It was like, it was a show that if anybody was going through either medical or divorce or heartache or something, it was the sort of the go-to comfort food for
them. Great.
Which is, are you kidding? It's amazing. It's amazing
thing.
That young people are still into a show where there's no social media, there's no cell phones until like midway through the show. There was no answering machines.
Right.
And I think they had a pager, like a drug dealer that they walked around with so they could communicate a little bit. It was really
And Melissa McCarthy.
And Melissa McCarthy, who took over for Alex Borstein, who was supposed to be
no kidding.
Suki.
That was the way that happened? I think she told me that.
Yeah. Yeah, but the Mad TV wouldn't let her out.
I just work with Melissa. I love her.
Yeah, Melissa's very talented.
So funny.
Yeah.
Just like so funny.
Yeah.
She's one of those people that can be so immediately funny on purpose. It's baffling.
Yeah.
There's not many of them.
But she's also, you know, like Alex, like she's somebody who has remarkable acting chops.
Yeah.
You know, and always had them. Like that's something that developed. Like she had them day one.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a great run. So you landed.
Good run. Yeah.
So, but you clearly after that, you wanted to do more.
Well, what else am I going to do? I'm trained for nothing. I have no children.
I know, but like, I don't either.
I have nothing to do if I'm not working. There's just nothing.
See, like, I don't have that. Like, for me, it's like the idea of working.
Is horrible.
No. I mean, I do comedy. I do this. I do, you know, the acting gigs here and there. And I do stuff. I work all the time. But the idea of getting involved with a TV show is a big fucking undertaking.
It's huge. It's huge.
And it's like, that's going to be your life. That's it.
Yes. Yeah, and it is your life. And if it's great, then your life is terrific. And if it's horrible, then your life is horrible. But you know, I've always sort of been able to, like, my whole career's been weird.
Yeah.
Like the one time I focused on something and said, I want this and went after it was the worst time of my entire life. It was that job, that Veronica's Closet job.
Yeah.
That forced me to.
But you also knew that you needed something to get where you wanted to get. And you hadn't gotten it yet. You said that. You wanted the executive producer credit.
Yeah.
So you could have some.
I thought that's what I needed. But I think actually what I needed was to stop doing sitcom. And so it, because sitcom was not my future.
Right. So the format of Gilmore Girls was something different. Was that what the dramedy?
It was, I don't know what you call it.
But an hour.
But it didn't require the endless pitching in rooms.
No joke. Not joke to joke.
Yeah. And frankly, when Gilmore came on, the WB didn't quite know what to do with it because it didn't quite fit the Dawson's Creek thing, and it wasn't Superman, and it wasn't Buffy. It didn't really, and the star was a 32-year-old woman, which was way out of their demographic at that time.
Yeah,
you know, they if you were menstruating, they had no interest in you. They really wanted them young, so it was just sort of like. But there was something about just being able to write something that was purely like whatever I wanted to do. And because Gilmore came in under the radar, that paid nothing for it. They sent us off to Canada. They had bigger problems. They had a couple of those big Bruckheimer shows or something that were blowing up all over the place. And by the time they paid attention to Gilmore, we got a lovely review. I mean, they just didn't really focus on it. And then they started to focus on it. There was a little bit of bullshit back and forth. There was the normal stuff where they call you at the beginning before you've premiered and they say, oh, we just want you to know the network's very angry and disappointed. And I said, well, I don't know what to tell you. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
Would you like to call my mother? You two can commiserate. Have a lovely conversation. And it happened quite a bit. And then finally I said, look, you guys, you can fire me. I'm happy to be fired.
Yeah.
Or you can never call me again, because what I can't do, I just know.
I'm not going to be abused.
But it's a blanket. I understand you're angry and disappointed. Just know the message has been received. Yeah. So you can, but you have many different ways you can go. So just tell me what it is. And they kind of went away for a while. And then we got a beautiful review in the Times, and they sent me flowers. And that was it. And I never heard from them again. It was great. And they didn't give me notes because they didn't.
So you didn't hear from them again?
Never heard from them again.
5 years?
No.
6
nothing,
years?
Nothing. It was complete. It was great. Complete silence. We just worked in a very tiny, in our own little vacuum. We took over the back lot.
Yeah.
We walked those girls around circles in Burbank.
Yeah.
And then, and that was the right atmosphere for me. Just like complete megalomania. Just a very, like, don't bother me.
Yeah.
If you don't like it, tell me to go away.
Yeah.
I will leave quietly.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I just really...
Well, what did happen with the last season?
Well, the last season, our contract was up.
Yeah.
And we were very burnt out because we had been writing every script.
After 5 or 6?
We were 6.
Okay.
We've done six seasons. And we went to Warner Brothers and we said, we don't need more money ourselves, but we need more writers and we need a directing producer on set.
Yeah.
We need that. We just have to have that.
Yeah.
We're
going to do another one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they said no.
Yeah.
Because they were used to us doing everything.
Yeah.
And we were kind of like, okay, well.
Yeah.
Okay. And we left. And we left. And they had another season. And I've never seen it. But Lauren Graham would call me once a week and say, I just want to read to you what I'm saying this week. Because Lauren's character was a character everybody was afraid of. They were afraid to write that character, and I don't know why.
Yeah.
You know, Lauren Graham is smart and sharp, and it's like, it's not a mystery what she's good at.
Right.
So I never quite understood.
And she couldn't understand what the new writers were doing?
No, because she was setting up for everybody else. They made her like the straight man. She, you know, she was Judd Hirsch.
Yeah.
And everybody else was, you know, Danny DeVito.
Because that's what they knew how to do.
Yeah.
So after that, there's just a couple more. What happened to the return of Jezebel James?
Oh, my God. Well, the last strike happened. I went to New York.
Because that was like Parker Posey,
that
right?
That was Parker Posey and Lauren Ambrose. Two unbelievably
great,
talented people.
Yeah.
But they work so differently. Like,
oh, really?
That was not a match made. Because Parker, I don't know if you've ever
live
met
wire.
Parker.
Yeah, I did.
Parker is all here.
Yeah. Right.
And Parker will sometimes, like, she would be rehearsing and she would stop and she wouldn't tell you why she was stopping.
Yeah.
And she would just, you would see her mind working and then she would just go back.
Yeah.
And start at some point in the, without telling anybody else, so nobody knew where they were supposed to be. Like, but that was just her.
Very present.
Thing. Yeah. Yeah. She was just like this.
Yeah.
A lot of headstands.
Yeah.
Cried every day at 4 o'clock. Every day at 4 o'clock, I'd have to hold, I've never held anyone so much in my life, but just crying. It's like, oh, it's 4. Okay. But she was just very like, you know, and Lauren is very, but why? But why?
Yeah.
But why is that funny? But why am I doing
well,
it that
it seems
way?
Like if you see them as characters,
yeah,
that they should work. But this is who they were.
It's people.
Right.
And both so talented.
Yeah.
And if they could have found a way to zhuzh together, I think it could have been really great.
Yeah.
But the writer's strike happened. So and then it was sort of like, we're
then
done.
It just disappears.
Yeah. And then we went on the line and we walked around with
And then
signs.
Like Bunheads was for your mom?
Bunheads. Butt Heads.
That's where you got your dancing thing in?
I got the dancing thing in. I got to work with Sutton Foster, who is my dream and my everything. I love her so much. And that was, it was a hot second of like, literally, I gave Capizio's my credit card and said, just keep the shoes coming. Because like, we had, talk about no money. Like, nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing at all.
Who was it for?
It was for ABC Family. Which does not exist anymore. They're called Freeform now.
And it was a dance class, a dance school.
Yeah, it was about a dance class, the dance school.
Wait, so you're going to ABC Family. You made a fortune off of Gilmore Girls. You're a big hit. You can do whatever you want. And then this was a passion project, or you thought, like, what?
You knew? I just need to do my shit. I don't want a deal. Like, deals freak me out.
Right.
I don't want to, like, we're under a deal now at Amazon, and although. Or are we? I don't know, because I think they're getting rid of all their deals now because of the strike. But we were
you're
under
done
a
with
deal.
This is the end of Maisel, right?
I know, but we were under a deal. So the thing is, when you're under a deal, you owe them your blood and your life. And I just sort of like.
So you don't. It's a matter of the work.
Yeah. I mean, look. I've made delightful money. I have a very comfortable lifestyle. I live in New York.
Yeah.
All I ever wanted to do was live in New York.
Yeah.
So I don't, you know, like I said, when you don't have kids, that's a huge
financial burden. What was
that choice? I just sort of felt like the madness needed to stop with me. I feel like it was time to sort of break the cycle.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just, it was, I think that what I do is very narcissistic.
Yeah.
It's very much what I
and
need.
And you like doing it.
And I'm
immersed.
Good at, and I just don't know how great I would be.
Right.
Responsible for another human to
Well, I mean, that's sort of the issue that Maisel has.
Yeah.
And what she got criticized for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we.
But the, people just had him then.
Rachel and I talked about this because and God love Rachel because she's so brave.
Yeah.
She didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
Like, she was surprised as I was that it was such an issue. But she felt like, well, yes, this woman is a complete narcissist. It's got to be, and if you want to reach the height she wanted to reach, you got to leave home.
Yeah,
you can't take the kids with you.
So where are we at? It's almost over, right?
No, it's done.
Okay,
it's hard. It's Isn't bad.
It? Well, it's like family, right?
It this cast.
Yeah, Shaloub's so sweet.
Was the it was we had a weird, weird bonding.
Yeah,
like a really like after 5 years, we never there was no. I've had enough of you.
Yeah,
and when the word came down. It was very hard. Like, we were very...
What do you mean it came down?
That it was last year.
But who said that? You? No. Oh, no shit.
No, it wasn't me. But things come to an end. I understand
but
that.
But I thought it was so successful.
Yeah, but, you know, there's orcs to pay for. There's a lot of orcs running around. They got to pay for the orcs. Maisel was a very expensive show by the end. It was very... I mean, all those bells and whistles cost. You know, doing period shows are very expensive. It's not just... It's not just the cars and the dresses and the sets.
Yeah.
It's all the work afterwards, taking out all the modern stuff.
Yes.
All the VHS. I mean, the special effects. You wouldn't think we were a special effects show. We got no dragons.
But aside from that, like, okay, you know, granted, you've been on shows that have gone on multiple years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even Gilmore Girls after six. I mean, it sounds like, in other words, it could have been done. So is there a part of you that feels like you've told this story?
Well, once we knew that we looked at that fifth season very differently.
Right.
And we had a fifth season plan that was not this fifth season.
Right.
It was a fifth season that was
sure
to go on.
Well, I mean, you had decades that you could have gone on.
Yeah. So
this show could have ended up with the beginning of Hacks.
Yeah.
Something
and she turns into after some terrible plastic surgery, she's taller.
Yeah.
And right. She's
well, you know what I mean. And she could have like, you know, gone through generations of comedy.
Yeah. 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 We touched on that in the fifth season.
Yeah.
You know. But we looked at the fifth season like, okay, let's land the plane.
Yeah.
And let's land it. You know, and because halfway through the fifth season, people started saying, well, I mean, what about a reboot? I'm like, oh my God, just let me land the plane.
Yeah,
let me
reboot.
Let me make sure that if people liked the show and if people watched the show, that at the end they feel like their journey was
fulfilled.
That's
closed. Yeah, absolutely.
That was very important to,
oh, great.
To me. So
well, that's
like,
good.
Yeah, I was very lucky. My whole career I've been very lucky. I fell into this.
Yeah.
I didn't seek it out. And I've worked with such great people, and I'm just very lucky. I'm so lucky to be where I am right now. And I, as sad as I am too, and also we were gonna do a panel on Monday, and we were all gonna be back together again. And then it's like, and we're on strike, and it's like, and we're not there.
Yeah.
But so it's a bummer, and I miss them desperately. I just miss seeing them every single day. But I had something that a lot of people go their whole career and they don't have. So I'm super lucky.
That's great.
Yeah.
And well, I'm sad, but I'm also happy. It sounds like a bittersweet thing. Yeah. Now, what do you think of Broadway?
I am worried about Broadway.
But I mean, what do you think about doing Broadway?
I would love to do Broadway. Broadway is, and I've toyed with it. I've stepped my foot into it.
It feels like
times.
It's where you should go.
I want to,
but not in a bad way.
Well, I want to do it.
It sounds like you have a. It feels like you have a Broadway show in you.
Well, thank you. I need to clear out. You need to clear stuff out because Broadway takes decades. It takes so long to mount a Broadway show, and there's so much work that goes into it.
Huh.
And I'm not afraid of that work. It's just I haven't. Broadway's not something you slip in.
Sure.
In between seasons.
Right.
Broadway is something you turn to and you go, okay, I'm here. I'm down.
You can
I'm
build
good.
This thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about it. I'm tipping my toe into a little something now. I love live theater more than anything. I just think there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
And it's great. And I worry that I want Broadway to come back full force.
Yeah.
It's still not.
It's
back
still
yet.
Not.
It's not back yet. The audiences aren't back. You know, everything's not back yet.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
And Broadway, there's no, like, you know, you need butts and seats. You need people to come.
Yeah, yeah. And get
sit.
These sort of amusement park ride shows.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
It's and a lot of, like, the smaller, more interesting shows get shoved out still.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm glad that I think they figured out a way for the Tonys to go on because the Tonys, unlike the Emmys and the Oscars,
sure.
The Tonys are their lifeblood because Tonys can save a show because people will watch a performance and go, oh, that looks interesting. I'll go see that. It's not the same for the others.
Right.
So it literally saves lives and careers and shows. And Beetlejuice was failing and they went on the Tonys and they had a huge...
Good run.
Good. And then suddenly they're like packed and people are coming to see it. So it's a life or death thing. So... They're doing the Tonys this year. I think that's important.
Yeah.
It's really, really great. It's a great and theater people are the best.
Yeah, sure.
Because they work harder than anybody else in the entire world.
And it's also immediate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's right. And it's different every time. I mean, there's something it's interesting like watching comedy on Netflix and things because it's fun to do, but it's not sitting in a club where something can go wrong.
Sure.
And it was interesting when the latest Chris Rock special, and I've since heard that maybe they've fixed it, but where everything was driving toward this one joke.
And it didn't go.
And he
fucked it up.
He fucked it up.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't watch it,
There was something kind of great about that moment.
Sure.
Because it reminded you, oh, wait a minute, this is a live animal.
Man, people used to tank all the time.
Yep.
Like, you know, it used to be something to watch. It's like that story you told about that guy who was, you know, sweet at the beginning of the night, but by the time he went on, it was a fucking disaster.
It's great. I mean, there's a sense of danger in theater. There's a sense of danger in comedy. The sense of danger is something that, you know, when you do TV, when you do movies, you can get rid of the danger.
Of course,
You know, and the danger's fun.
Well, I hope you do something.
Well, we'll see.
Nice talking to you.
I'm trying. Thank you for having me.
Okay, there you go. That was exciting, lively. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel comes to an end tomorrow night, May 26th. On Prime Video, you can watch all 5 seasons now. Hang out for a minute, will you? Hey, folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me. A tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on. Folks, we've got a special treat this week for Full Marin listeners. We pulled out some old segments of the show that not a lot of people have heard, with guests that made people at the time say, what the fuck?
Were the ends well-defined or were they blobby?
The ends, movement? I didn't spend a lot of time looking at it. Now, maybe should I look at it and call you back?
No, you can just try to remember it.
Oh, yeah, it was good.
You talk about it, the better.
It was, you know, I pinched it off. And it had a nice tail on it.
Okay, was it fluffy with ragged edges? Right,
wait,
the tail.
This is getting me a little uncomfortable. I mean, I'm playing along here, but okay. So now we're on like the sixth question about the shit.
That's what people who are homebound have to talk about. That, and that is also very common. That's basically what unites us.
Hey man, you're okay. You cool? You're cool. I mean, you're cool.
Wow. Fuck.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Okay. All right. Just breathe, dude.
Yeah.
Just breathe, bro. Hey, man.
I can only breathe out.
No. You can just pull in. Pull in. Pull in. No, just pull in. Yeah. No. Now do both. One after the other. You have to do. Okay. That's all right.
Yes, Senor Juarez, do you have a question for me or El Chupacabra?
Mark Mayer,
yes.
Why don't you believe in God?
Because I just don't find that I have a need to believe in God.
Well, what happened when you die?
Nothing. Wow. Is he all right? Hello? Hello?
Oh, that's a shame. I think Senor Juarez... I think Senor Juarez just found out what was about to happen to him.
We've had our first death on the air by caller on a show that has never taken calls before. This is a tremendous experience.
Oh.
I recorded some of my thoughts and memories of those clips as well. These were things that only happened during the first year of the show and only about a dozen times. To hear that bonus episode plus all the weekly bonus material, as well as all WTF episodes ad-free, click on the link in the episode description to sign up for the Full Marin on WTF Plus. You can also go to WTFpod.com and click on the WTF Plus tab at the top of the page. All right? Put a will together. Get your ass checked. My new record. Here's some guitar. Monkey, LaFonda, cat angels everywhere, all right?